We would like to acknowledge that Footnotes is based on the unceded land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We acknowledge the traditional owners of this land and pay respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. This land always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. Juries, the backbone of the everyday public's participation in the Australian legal system. They are tasked with the most important decision in trials and made up of people theoretically drawn randomly from our electoral roll. Juries symbolically ensure our legal system is transparent to the everyday person, providing a neutral voice in what otherwise threatens to be an echo chamber of legal professionals. But, like every other part of the Australian legal system, it has its issues. From the impanelling process itself, to whether or not jurors can speak to and seek out the media, the Australian jury is not without its controversies. So, we thought we'd do a little deep dive into one of the most established parts of the Australian court. So, join us as we examine the Australian jury system, its intricacies, and ask, well, could it be done any better? So the way this episode is going to work is we're going to take you through the entire juror process, explain how each of these sections work, and then also bring out some of the bigger issues that they each raise. We have split this episode into three sections. Number one, the impanelling process. Number two, the trial itself. And number three, deliberations, post-trial, and future speculations. So I will now hand over to Brandon and Tamsin, who are going to get us started.
Thanks, Jacinda. I'm Tamsin.
And I'm Brandon.
And to begin our first section on the impanelling process, we need to first look at how people become part of the jury pool. Just as a quick rehash, potential jurors are first placed on a jury roll, which is a list of names randomly selected by a computer from the electoral roll.
And once you've been placed onto the jury roll, you'll be sent a letter of inclusion to let you know. And then over the next 12 months, jurors will be chosen from that specific list. If chosen, those jurors are summoned to report to court on a particular day for jury service.
Once the trial is to begin, the impanelling process starts. These potential jurors are taken to the courtroom where they are given a chance to let the judge know if they know of any of the parties in the trial.
Then the judge's associate randomly draws out jurors from a ballot box, sort of like a lottery, and these jurors then take a seat in the juror box until it's filled. Now, this is where something called the peremptory challenge can be used. So this peremptory challenge is an opportunity for either counsel, plaintiff or defendant, or prosecution and defendant, to veto any potential juror from being impaneled without having to give any reason or justification. Now, in a criminal trial, the prosecutor and defence counsel are both allowed a maximum of three challenges each. And for the defence, if people are tried together, that's three per defendant. But in practice, with the prosecutor's challenges, it's rarely used, but it's retained its status as a long-held right of the defendant to exercise a peremptory challenge.
Now, it's with this process that a lot of issues are raised. The central one is that it enables counsel to make immediate age, gender, and race assessments and remove jurors on that basis. In fact, the New South Wales Law Reform Commission stated, quote, "Challenging is an arbitrary exercise dependent upon guesswork and dubious mythology, and it's not necessarily conducive to securing a fair, impartial, or representative jury." And we can really see this in the fact that the most frequently challenged groups of people are women, young people, and people of colour. Specifically, the jury's commissioner's office noted that for every man challenged, two women are challenged. But on a rare occasion, this is accounted for. So specifically for First Nations defendants, an all-white jury may be discharged. Specifically, the Australian Law Reform Commission states, quote, "On the other hand, the court has an inherent power to ensure that a fair trial is achieved, and direct or indirect attempts at jury vetting may bring this power into play. For example, in R.N. Smith, involving a First Nations person accused, Judge Martin, sitting in the Bourke District Court, discharged an all-white jury and adjourned the case for a later hearing, after the Crown had challenged all First Nations people on the jury panel. However, I think it's fair to still raise the argument that although there have been attempts to account for diversity in society, challenging juries nonetheless involves assumptions based on race, gender, and class. And so consequently, it is, I think, inherently prejudiced." You could make that argument.
I definitely agree with that. I think that New South Wales Law Reform Commission quote that you read out about the dubious mythology gets to that heart of what it is, because over time, Australia has definitely become a more multicultural place, and that may not be reflected necessarily in how our barristers and our counsel who are proceeding in criminal trials advise their clients. There may be this mythology from many years of anecdotal experience that sort of carries on, that says women are not to be trusted or people of colour are not helpful for a defendant in a certain case. And I think in that respect, that peremptory challenge, although it's necessary in certain respects for the defendant to have the ability to that, when it is based on those sort of dubious mythology or inherent guesswork of saying this person looks like this category, therefore we get rid of them, inherently reduces the representative nature of juries.
Yeah, it is important to note that it is essential to be able to challenge jury members. However, while we may be statistically a very multicultural country, that is not necessarily reflected in the prevailing attitudes within our society, not to mention our extremely shameful colonial history. I think the way that the challenges are being conducted now on this very much like a dubious mythology basis, it's allowing for these prejudices to really come to light in the courtroom, which I think it implores us to pause for reconsideration, because isn't the court meant to be impartial?
So as we've just discussed, this practice of the peremptory challenge has some key issues. The first of those is that it undermines the whole theoretical goal of juries, that an accused is judged by their peers on the evidence as presented in the court. However, there's another sort of theoretical goal of juries, Tamsin, that I thought of, which is that the jurors had to aid in facilitating a fair trial. As you know, the right to a fair trial is sort of a tenet of the common law, and that in that right to a fair trial, the defendants should have a reasonable belief that they're being given a fair trial. What do you sort of see with that sort of idea of at one side it's judged by their peers and at the other side it's the defendant's perception of a fair trial? What do you think?
I think when it comes to the idea of a fair trial, you need to judge that by an objective standard rather than what the defendant would like in that circumstance, because then it's going to become very inconsistent. But at the same time, I think that we need to consider what a fair trial would be from a defendant's perspective. And I think in that circumstance, we need to ensure that they have access to a representative cross-section of society. And I say that because that has been noted quite frequently in the discussions I've come across, that that representative cross-section is inextricably tied to a fair trial. And I think that's really highlighted in the example of Bree Lee, who she's an author of The Eggshell Skull, incredible book. And she recounted a time when a friend of hers was watching a trial that she was involved in and noted that counsel attempted to challenge all women. And this was a sexual assault trial. And so I think in those circumstances, that would be a really egregious example of undermining a fair trial in that circumstance, because you're completely denying them a representative cross-section of society. So I think those would be my two cents on that issue.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there is something to be said about an objective standard of a fair trial. And I think, as is often said, the criminal justice system must give justice and also be seen to give justice. So I think a weighing up of those things is always necessary. But yes, coming back to that, there has to be definitely an objective standard to which it can be sort of judged upon, because ultimately a trial should be something that finds the facts as it is and correctly finds guilt or innocence, not sort of be balanced towards or be weighted towards the defendant in sort of getting out if they were in fact guilty.
I think when it comes to that fact assessment role of a jury, if you're denying someone the opportunity to be assessed by or have their actions assessed by a wider demographic, then you're really skewing that process. And so I think this issue of the makeup of juries cannot be ignored, and it's really inextricably tied to the discussion of a fair trial, especially for minorities. I think if you were to dismiss this issue, it would just go to creating biases within what's meant to be an impartial process. I think if you really want impartiality, you need to ensure that one group is not overrepresented in that assessment. Another really key issue going off of that, juries are meant to be randomly selected and a representative cross-section of society. And if you, like me, subscribe to the view that a representative jury that does not bias one demographic is inextricably tied to a fair trial, then the current makeup of juries is going to raise a few alarm bells for you. So currently, we do have some demographics that are overwhelmingly predominating on juries. Specifically, right now, middle-class men are very overrepresented in juries, and professionals are more likely to be exempt. And as aforementioned, women are more likely to be challenged. And I think this really skewed makeup of juries that we're seeing is highlighted in Lord Delvin back in 1956, saying the average juror is male, middle-aged, middle-minded, and middle-class. And this is not me saying that any one demographic of people should not be able to observe on a jury. That is not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is right now we just have one. And like I said before, it's not very representative. It's sort of, it's creating a friction between what a jury should involve in theory and what it's looking like in practice.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about that theory and practice part, one of the things that is most controversial about the current jury system is the idea of exclusions for people from jury service and exemptions from people from jury service, which are mentioned in Section 6 and 7 of the Jury Act. So people who are excluded don't have to serve at all. They're not qualified and not liable, as the language of the Act put it, to serve on the jury. But people who are exempted have a right to say to the judge when they're being impaneled, I have an exclusion, I will be off jury duty, and there's no two ways about it. If they claim the exemption and they're under it, they get out of jury. So let's go through some of the exemptions and the exclusions. And some of these definitely have a bit of tension as to why they are still needed as such a strong either exclusion or exemption in the fact that they pretty much automatically get out of it without any further consideration of the circumstances, or whether they should even be there in the first place. So the first one is about criminals, and it is people who have been found guilty or convicted of terrorism offences, an offence that would be punishable with a maximum penalty of life imprisonment, or an offence under Part 7 of the Public Justice Offences of the Crimes Act, or a sexual offence. For these ones, this is an exclusionary rule where people who are convicted of these never get to serve on juries again. A similar sort of exclusionary rule is that a person may be excluded for 7 years after their service of a sentence of imprisonment for less than 3 consecutive months, or 10 years of exclusion from service if it's 3 consecutive months or more. Now, Tamsin, what do you say to this second one of the two, where it's the exclusion for 7 or 10 years for those imprisonment? Do you think that that is justified as something, as an exclusion, full stop, no further consideration of anything, just read the Act, apply it, nothing else?
Look, this issue is one that I don't have a definitive answer on, because the service of a custodial sentence of less than 3 consecutive months indicates an offence. While it's not trivial, it's not egregious, I guess you could say. So I think it would be useful to have specified categories of offence that would fall under the 3 consecutive months exclusion. Because I do acknowledge the fact that, yes, it's only 3 consecutive months, but that's 3 consecutive months out of an imprisonment sentence. Imprisonment is not the only sentence available. And for that to be warranted in circumstances where we know it can lead to institutionalization and just an overall recurrence of crime, it's not handed out lightly, from my understanding. So I think that even though it's lower on the scale of imprisonment, it's nonetheless an imprisonment sentence. So why should they serve in a court? However, at the same time, it's a finding of fact. You can make the argument it's not a moral assessment and it's not a judgment in theory, but I think to counter that, you could also make the judgment that you're nonetheless going to allow for those moral judgments to seep in the jury deliberations. It's quite inevitable. So I think, understand this exemption based on the fact that it's an imprisonment sentence, and that theoretically, why should a person who has undermined the law in such a direct way to warrant that sentence serve as a juror within it?
Well, moving on to the exemptions now. Members of the clergy, dentists, pharmacists, medical practitioners, people who are paid part-time or full-time firefighters, paramedics, or SES workers, as well as people who are undertaking full-time care work, with that being both people who are paid as carers and people who volunteer in a volunteer capacity as carers, which is quite a large proportion of the Australian population. That final one about the person who is undertaking full-time care work can include people who have children, particularly young children, and the courts have been relatively generous in granting exemptions in the past for that.
The potential problematic nature of having skewed juries in terms of really creating this tension between the theory of a juries and practice is really highlighted in recent law reform. So Victoria has acknowledged the problem of bias on juries and reduced the number of offered challenges to 4. And peremptory challenges have been abolished in the United Kingdom.
I think there's something to be said about having another look at peremptory challenges. I think the last one was done in 2006 by the New South Wales Law Reform Commission. So 16 years ago, so that's a long time to be running on the same sort of formula. But I think as Tamsin and I have sort of gone through, there are definitely issues that exist, but it has been a practice that is so embedded in our jury system about the peremptory challenges that it has just stayed for now. And I think what we've heard is they theoretically safeguard impartiality and restrict judicial discretion and remove jurors who will be undoubtedly discriminatory. And I think how jurors should perceive the peremptory challenge is well summed up by the Department of Communities and Justice, which says that when a peremptory challenge is exercised, this is not a personal reflection on you. This is a right under our laws.
You mentioned removing jurors who will be undoubtedly discriminatory. I think there's something to say in response to that in terms of the sort of dubious mythology we mentioned before. How can you know that something, that someone will be undoubtedly discriminatory on such a narrow basis of gender, race, class, etc.? Like, again, this is like a tension between theory and practice. Even though we can say it's a right under the laws, the right has been exercised on the basis of personal characteristics of potential jurors. So I think even though we're trying to remove jurors who will be undoubtedly discriminatory, you can't make the assessment of undoubtedly discriminatory on such a narrow basis. All right, now we're going to move on to the trial itself. Now, during the trial, as I am sure most of you already know, the jury is expected to listen to both sides of the case to deliver the joint verdict. To go a little bit into the details of this process, firstly, after the counsels present their case, the judge will summarise the case's issues, arguments, and the evidence presented in what is called the judge's summing up. Now, the particularly interesting and potentially contentious part that comes after this is the judge's directions to the jury. During this section, the judge will tell the jurors the laws relevant to the issue at hand, especially ensuring that they know how the law can and should be applied. This process has actually come under examination before, in fact, by the New South Wales Law Reform Commission in 2012. They said that the system of jury directions continues to operate according to the basic premise that jurors will have difficulty in fulfilling their responsibilities without any guidance from the judge. Jury directions aim to help jurors carry out their role of deciding issues of fact in the light of the applicable principles of law. In doing so, jury directions serve the large purpose of ensuring a fair trial, or, to put it differently, of avoiding any, quote, perceptible risk of miscarriage of justice, unquote. So this all seems very straightforward. Of course, people who aren't familiar with the law should be provided guidance on the law when they're making such a big legal decision as providing a verdict in a trial. However, research has found that often the juror's interpretation of the law can be contradictory. This can have huge implications, as research has shown that juries have varied in understanding what beyond reasonable doubt means. Specifically, Lily Tromboli in Juror Understanding of Judicial Instructions in Criminal Trials surveyed 1,225 jurors from the District or Supreme Court in Sydney, Wollongong and Newcastle. She found that around half of these jurors, specifically 55.4%, believed beyond reasonable doubt to mean sure that the person is guilty. A fifth, or 22.9%, believed that it meant almost sure the person is guilty, and about a tenth, 10.1%, believed it meant pretty likely the person is guilty.
Well, albeit the research was done in 2008, so quite a while ago, but it does paint an alarming picture that our jurors are having such a varied understanding of the law when they are applying it, especially when someone's freedom could be in their hands. And this is not helped by precedents that specifically say that judges should not clarify what the burden of proof is. At a federal level, in Green and R, in 1971, heard before the High Court of Australia, it was held that judges should not give juries classification on what beyond reasonable doubt means. And then in R and Dukia in 2017, also heard before the High Court of Australia, they stated that while it is generally undesirable for a trial judge to contrast reasonable doubt with proof beyond any doubt, it was not an error to do so in the circumstances of this case. So there are still certain circumstances where there could be clarifications, it seems, but it's still quite uncertain about the nuances of how much exactly can a judge clarify on the burden of proof, despite research showing that it could be an issue of contention. In New South Wales, there is no legislative provision for directing the jury on the burden of proof. Instead, the Criminal Trial Court's bench book provides a suggested direction that emphasizes that the meaning of the beyond reasonable doubt is its own terms without providing any further guidance. In Victoria, Part 7 of the Jury Directions Act 2015 outlines the requirements for judges and gives broader allowance or at least protection than New South Wales. It should be noted that special directions can be used sometimes to provide further clarity on the burden of proof, but these are not mandated and can often require very specific circumstances to trigger. An instance would be the Liberato direction, named after the case from which it originates. This direction is applicable in cases which turn on a contradiction of evidence presented by the defendant and the Crown. So essentially, the Crown and the defendant are presenting a piece of evidence that essentially could determine the outcome of the case, but the two accounts, usually like witness statements, are completely contradictory of each other. The fear in these types of situations is that the jury will then determine guilt based on which piece of contradicting evidence they believe, without proper heed for the burden of proof. In situations like this, the judge should direct the jury that A preference for the prosecution evidence is not enough. The jury must not convict unless satisfied beyond reasonable doubt of the truth of that evidence. And B, even if the evidence relied upon by the accused is not positively believed, the jury must not convict if that evidence gives rise to a reasonable doubt about guilt. Now, whilst this direction is really important and it does help clarify the burden of truth, whether it is required depends upon the issues and the conduct of each trial. Though, it has been noted that it should be provided where without the direction, there is a risk that, quote, the jury may be left with an impression that A, the evidence upon which the accused relies will only give rise to a reasonable doubt if that evidence is believed as truthful, or B, a preference for the evidence led by the prosecution is sufficient to establish guilt. As said by Justice Bellew in the Haley and R 2022 case. Apart from the Liberato direction, there are also other directions that can be evoked that do affect the burden of proof. For example, if the evidence is an indispensable link in the chain of reasoning, the jury should be directed that all the evidence adduced in a trial should meet the required standard of proof, as established in the Shepherd case in 1990 and the Haynes and DPP case in 2006. Now, we just want to note that this research does seem to make judge directions come across as quite alarming, that we've got jurors not understanding the burden of proof, but it should be noted that these issues aside, research has found that jurors do largely understand the cases that they are deciding on. By the same study that I mentioned earlier, 94% of jurors stated that they either completely understood the judge's instructions on the law or understood most things the judges said. And whilst it seems that there isn't anything largely controversial or anything to write about within the trial in the jury process, it does seem that, as with the law, it is going to be constantly changing and there still stands for room for improvement.
So now we've got through the impaneling process, the jury has sat through the trial, and now we move to the deliberations and post-trial section. Tamsin's back with me. Hi, Tamsin.
Hi.
So the question is, in this section, what are juries allowed to do, or more accurately, what are they not allowed to do after they finish hearing the evidence? In a nutshell, Australian jurors are not allowed to say anything publicly.
Yeah, the jury deliberation process is highly secretive. The behaviour of jurors during deliberations, or how interpersonal dynamics between jurors influence the end result, is really under research as a topic of inquiry. One of the reasons why is because jury deliberations are prevented from being disclosed under threat of criminal prosecution.
Yeah, and you mentioned that threat of criminal prosecution. As a general rule, no one's actually permitted to harass or solicit information from a juror or former juror to find out about those deliberations or how any conclusions were made on the evidence that was tendered. The maximum penalty, as set out in Section 68A of the Jury Act, is 7 years imprisonment. There's exceptions to that general rule for public authorities to help manage the juries, as well as when approval has been given for jury research. However, with all this jury secrecy, as you mentioned, Tamsin, even sworn affidavits about mistakes in the jury room have been held in court cases as inadmissible when they have been used to try and overturn a conviction. So it just shows how secretive and how, I guess, there's such a sanctity to jury deliberations.
Yeah, and Brandon, not only are ordinary people not allowed to seek information on deliberations, jurors are also not allowed to talk to people who are not on the jury about deliberations or their own opinions. This is quite different from the US, where jurors have been known to release books on their deliberations in high-profile trials, as well as appear on television programs. More on that a bit later in the episode. In New South Wales, where no fee is involved in disclosing information, the maximum fine is $2,200 under Section 68B, subsection 1. But when a fee is involved, the maximum fine increases to $5,500.
And in that comparison between Australia and the United States, there's really two main justifications here in New South Wales for the amount of secrecy that goes on in those jury rooms. Firstly, being confidentiality, and then secondly, protecting that right to a fair trial that we've talked about through this episode. So first, to ensuring confidentiality, that's essentially meaning that jurors in the room can more freely discuss their points of view on the case they're serving on without any public ridicule or public criticism or sort of public comment about what they're doing. And New South Wales legislation, in fact, has ensured that from the moment of impaneling to well after the trial is concluded, jurors' names and identities should not be published or broadcast, also by threat of significant fines. And as a side note, in New South Wales, jurors will usually be called by their number inside a court, with the only information that those at the bar table, being the counsel, having about a juror being only their juror ID.
Yeah, and going off of that, Brandon, the current legislation tries to ensure that what is said in jury deliberations stays in jury deliberations. The second argument is protecting the right to a fair trial, meaning that juries are compelled to only consider the admissible evidence they have been presented with, nothing more and nothing less. A fair trial, especially in the New South Wales criminal trial system, relies on both parties presenting their own evidence and leaving it with the jury as to whether the accused is guilty or not.
But with all this secrecy, there's always the question of what's being covered up. Given the jury seems to be a Pandora's box that sort of cannot be opened, what about the wrongs of others? And with that process, we as a general public never really get to know about that decision-making process that was applied. We can't be sure that jurors did not ask others for advice, even though we may suspect at times people do go home and ask their partner or their wife or their brother or something about how they would have seen or heard something in the news or how they would weigh up the evidence. We can't get any sort of idea about that. And we can't also be 100% certain that jurors followed the rules and didn't conduct their own investigations.
And Brandon, those benefits and consequences of the current system that were just mentioned all reflect back to the central idea that the jury deliberation process raises a central issue about the transparency of our legal system. On the one hand, the lack of an ability for jurors to speak out, explain their decisions, or be questioned on their reasoning process means that one of the key decision makers in a criminal trial never needs to explain how they determine the guilt or innocence of the accused, which I think raises the possibility for some things that were not evidence presented at the trial to be taken into consideration, which is potentially problematic, especially, again, when you think of the court as this theoretically impartial institution. But on the other hand, the current system protects jury members from retribution, ensures that the rules of evidence are followed by ensuring that public pressure does not play a role in jury deliberations, and leaves jury duty to be a civic duty, not one where the economic incentive for a tell-all interview or book may also play on the mind of jurors. The jury system as is also gives a perception that has been described as silence protects public confidence in the justice system. So some things to consider.
And just one final point to make about evidence in the trial. As has been mentioned before, juries must evaluate the evidence being the evidence as tendered in the courtroom. They are not permitted to undertake their own investigations outside the court. In some notable New South Wales cases, a mistrial has been declared because jurors have gone outside their remit and gone and investigated parts of alleged crime scenes and parts of the evidence in what they thought was a greater ability for them to properly discern the evidence. This prohibition includes asking a person a question, doing field research, internet research, or conducting scientific experiments, with the maximum penalty here being 2 years or $5,500 or both under Section 68C. An example of the seriousness of this rule was in the trials of Bilal and Mohammed Scaff in Sydney, where a few jurors actually went out to the alleged crime scene to assess lighting conditions. In that case, the actions of these jurors resulted in both defendants' convictions being overturned and a retrial being ordered, essentially undoing the whole work of all the jury and essentially being a waste of time for both prosecution and defence in their original trials.
So there's our jury system in a nutshell, and some of the issues it definitely raises along the way. But I guess the question we're all pondering is there a better option? And I'm going to throw that question to our resident American here at Footnotes. Nick, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts in this was definitely best started with comparing the Australian system to the American system, particularly in regards to media and its role on juries. So a 2021 study from the University of Nebraska suggests that despite media constantly portraying jury duty as something undesirable and to be avoided, Americans actually have more trust in their jury system than Australians. And the American participants in the study scored higher than the Australians when perceiving things like the jurors' perception, their impartiality, their fairness, and their respect. This article also made some suggestions as to why this might be the case. And one of those suggestions was that the emphasis on secrecy from Australian jurors actually hurts their perception. Because of the strict law for secrecy that we have in this country, most trials can only be viewed or understood by either dense court reports or by media coverage. And in the States, trusted media is at a 26%, the second lowest rating ever recorded in the country, and dead last among 40 countries studied by Statista earlier this year. Access to jurors' opinions in the States, this article argues that it allows for a necessary counterbalance to the media coverage that people don't trust by allowing a direct insight into the processes of the jury system. In Australia, though, trust in the media sits at 41%, which is better than the US's mark, but still solidly in a majority of untrustworthiness. And furthermore, a global market research firm called IPSOS reported that trust in Australian media has declined consistently from 2014 to 2019 and has yet to rise back to the pre-14 levels. And with technological advances making media increasingly more accessible and trust in media continuing to fall, it may be necessary to review these policies and go to something a little bit more akin to the American way.
And Nick, what do you think about the fact that jurors in the States have signed book deals before verdicts have actually been delivered in the past? Like, for example, the private diary of an OJ juror.
I mean, obviously that's not ideal. And I think with all these systems, you're going to get pros and you're going to get cons.
Yeah.
And it definitely contributes to the treatment of the courtroom processes as a kind of spectacle. And maybe in some very rare circumstances, like an O.J. Simpson trial that's an incredible spectacle in itself, it definitely can highlight the shortcomings of this process. But the thing with American juries that I think Australians don't do as much is the voir dire, the selection process to actually create the impartial jury. The American process in doing so is very extensive and takes out anybody from the jury who may be biased or may contribute to an unfair jury. And unfortunately, you do still get people who will capitalize on very well-known and well-marketed cases. But the truth is, 80% of people in Australia have a smartphone, and that number is only going to keep going up. There is so much saturation with media and so many varieties of media that there's really no way to go back to the days before the O.J. Simpson trial and before people can access anything at any time. And I think these jury laws that we have now are a little stuck in the past. Nowadays, roughly 80% of Australians have access to smartphones, which means media is just going to continue to have a bigger effect on our jurors. And this external pressure is not something that's new. In a May 2004 case called the Queen v. Shake, the court decided to overturn because of the inescapable and obvious prejudicial effect of the publicity from the first trial that happened in that case. And a bunch of cases in the past decade have been thrown out due to the increased access to media, like the Queen and Gaskell in Queensland in 2014, where a murder charge was thrown out when a juror did her own research on Facebook. Earlier this year in Huang v. the Queen, where a decision was quashed against a tutor accused of sexual offenses against children because jurors went off and did their own research.
Nick, it seems like it's pretty idealistic to assume that jurors are going to be completely immunized from the media and public perceptions of a trial. But if we look at the US system again and the fact that jurors have released books, full verdicts have been released, etc., do you think that that poses the danger of potentially encouraging jury deliberations to be less frank and less transparent because jurors might become concerned with being incriminated in the court of public opinion following the book's release if it turns out that they were wrong or they didn't believe another juror's interpretation of the evidence or didn't agree, I should say. What would you think about that? Do you think that the sort of pros of this system outweigh the cons?
Yeah, well, like anything else, it's a balancing act. And I think there are certainly cons that come with it, just like there are cons with everything. I think you see them most notably in trials like the O.J. Simpson trial and the Menendez trials, where books were released by the jurors. And obviously, those trials had massive recognition in the United States and also internationally, even here in Australia. I've heard about it in my evidence course. But I think it's unwise to get discouraged over these few exceptions, these few very well-advertised exceptions. I think the research all points to the idea that as trust in media is declining, as access to more media sites, and a lot of times even less reputable media sites, has increased, the more open that our justice system can be, the better.
Yeah, I guess it becomes this balancing act between, on the one hand, encouraging transparency and public confidence in the jury system, and on the other hand, trying to minimize transparency, but at the same time, immunize it from those public concerns, therefore try and create more impartial outcomes, more impartial assessments of the evidence. I guess there's no one utopian jury system that we've come across yet.
Yeah, unfortunately, the world doesn't work in black and white and absolutes. Tons of gray space in between. But I think one thing that everyone can agree on is that technology is changing every aspect of our lives, including how we access media, how we communicate with each other, and also what we can see every single day. And I think our jury system here in Australia, it should reflect those changes. And I think even if it doesn't go all the way into the United States way of being, I think we can learn from how they've done things and meet somewhere in the middle.
That's such a friendly ending.
Yeah, I hope all the trials come with friendly endings like that.
But now we're going to give you another friendly ending. We're going to throw it back to Jacinta, who's going to wrap up the episode for us.
Thanks, Jacinta.
Thanks, Townsend and Nick. The Australian jury system, like many parts of Australian law, presents its own unique issues. There is only so much we can get through in a single podcast episode, and from our research, I can tell you we have only just scratched the surface. If you want to read further on this issue, we've linked some of the core sources we used in the description of this episode. Also, make sure you follow Sols on Instagram at Sols_Sydney and like their Facebook page where we place updates on all things footnotes. We hope you've learnt something new about the fascinating world of Australian jurors, but for now, I'm Jacinda and we're the Footnotes team, signing off.